she answered with some trepidation, and went out. "She was good-looking, wasn't she?" said the manager's companion, who had not caught all the details of the game he had played. "Yes, in a way," said the other, sore to think the game had been lost. "She'd never make an actress, though. Just another chorus girl, that's all." This little experience nearly destroyed her ambition to call upon the manager at the Chicago Opera House, but she decided to do so after a time. He was of a more sedate turn of mind. He said at once that there was no opening of any sort and seemed to consider her search foolish. "Chicago is no place to get a start," he said. "You ought to be in New York." Still, she persisted and went to McVickers, where she could not find anyone. The old homestead was running there, but the person to whom she was referred was not to be found. These little expeditions took up her time until quite 4 o'clock, when she was weary enough to go home. She felt as if she ought to continue and inquire elsewhere, but the results so far were too dispiriting. She took the car and arrived at Ogden Place in 3/4 of an hour, but decided to ride on to the West Side branch of the post office, where she was accustomed to receive Hurstwood's letters. There was one there now, written Saturday, which she tore open and read with mingled feelings. There was so much warmth in it, and such tense complaint at her having failed to meet him, and her subsequent silence, that she rather pitied the man. That he loved her was evident enough. That he had wished and dared to do so, married as he was the evil. She felt as if the thing deserved an answer, and consequently decided that she would write and let him know that she knew of his married state, and was justly incensed at his deception. She would tell him that it was all over between them. At her room, the wording of this missive occupied her for some time, for she fell to the task at once. It was most difficult. "You do not need to have me explain why I did not meet you," she wrote in part. "How could you deceive me so? You could not expect me to have anything more to do with you. I wouldn't under any circumstances." "Oh, how could you act so?" she added in a burst of feeling. "You have caused me more misery than you can think. I hope you will get over your infatuation for me. We must not meet any more. Goodbye." She took the letter the next morning, and at the corner dropped it reluctantly into the letter box, still uncertain as to whether she should do so or not. Then she took the car and went downtown. This was the dull season with the department stores, but she was listened to with more consideration than was usually accorded to young women applicants, owing to her neat and attractive appearance. She was asked the same old questions with which she was already familiar. "What can you do? Have you ever worked in a retail store before? Are you experienced?" At the fair, C and Company's, and all the great stores, it was much the same. It was the dull season. She might come in a little later. Possibly they would like to have her. When she arrived at the house at the end of the day, weary and disheartened, she discovered that Drouet had been there. His umbrella and light overcoat were gone. She thought she missed other things, but could not be sure. Everything had not been taken. So his going was crystallizing into staying. What was she to do now? Evidently, she would be facing the world in the same old way within a day or two. Her clothes would get poor. She put her two hands together in her customary expressive way and pressed her fingers. Large tears gathered in her eyes and broke hot across her cheeks. She was alone, very much alone. Drouet really had called, but it was with a very different mind from that which Carrie had imagined. He expected to find her, to justify his return by claiming that he came to get the remaining portion of his wardrobe, and before he got away again to patch up a piece. Accordingly, when he arrived, he was disappointed to find Carrie out. He trifled about, hoping that she was somewhere in the neighborhood and would soon return. He constantly listened, expecting to hear her foot on the stair. When he did so, it was his intention to make believe that he had just come in and was disturbed at being caught. Then he would explain his need of his clothes and find out how things stood. Wait as he did, however, Carrie did not come. From pottering around among the drawers, in momentary expectation of her arrival, he changed to looking out of the window, and from that to resting himself in the rocking chair. Still no Carrie. He began to grow restless and lit a cigar. After that, he walked the floor. Then he looked out of the window and saw clouds gathering. He remembered an appointment at 3. He began to think that it would be useless to wait, and got hold of his umbrella and light coat, intending to take these things anyway. It would scare her, he hoped. Tomorrow he would come back for the others. He would find out how things stood. As he started to go, he felt truly sorry that he had missed her. There was a little picture of her on the wall, showing her arrayed in the little jacket he had first bought her, her face a little more wistful than he had seen it lately. He was really touched by it, and looked into the eyes of it with a rather rare feeling for him. "You didn't do me right, Cat," he said, as if he were addressing her in the flesh. Then he went to the door, took a good look around, and went out. 27. When waters engulf us, we reach for a star. It was when he returned from his disturbed stroll about the streets, after receiving the decisive note from McGregor, James, and Hay, that Hurstwood found the letter Carrie had written him that morning. He thrilled intensely as he noted the handwriting and rapidly tore it open. Then, he thought, she loves me, or she would not have written to me at all. He was slightly depressed at the tenor of the note for the first few minutes, but soon recovered. She wouldn't write at all if she didn't care for me. This was his one resource against the depression which held him. He could extract little from the wording of the letter, but the spirit he thought he knew. There was really something exceedingly human, if not pathetic, in his being thus relieved by a clearly worded reproof. He who had for so long remained satisfied with himself now looked outside of himself for comfort, and to such a source. The mystic cords of affection, how they bind us all. The color came to his cheeks. For the moment he forgot the letter from McGregor, James, and Hay. If he could only have Carrie, perhaps he could get out of the whole entanglement. Perhaps it would not matter. He wouldn't care what his wife did with herself if only he might not lose Carrie. He stood up and walked about, dreaming his delightful dream of a life continued with this lovely possessor of his heart. It was not long, however, before the old worry was back for consideration, and with that, what weariness! He thought of the morrow and the suit. He had done nothing, and here was the afternoon slipping away. It was now 4:15. At 5, the attorneys would have gone home. He still had the morrow until noon. Even as he thought, the last 15 minutes passed away, and it was 5. Then he abandoned the thought of seeing them any more that day and turned to Carrie. It is to be observed that the man did not justify himself to himself. He was not troubling about that. His whole thought was the possibility of persuading Carrie. Nothing was wrong in that. He loved her dearly. Their mutual happiness depended upon it. Would that Drouet were only away. While he was thinking thus elatedly, he remembered that he wanted some clean linen in the morning. This he purchased, together with a half-dozen ties, and went to the Palmer House. As he entered, he thought he saw Drouet ascending the stairs with a key. Surely not Drouet. Then he thought, perhaps they had changed their abode temporarily. He went straight up to the desk. "Is Mr. Drouet stopping here?" he asked of the clerk. "I think he is," said the latter, consulting his private registry list. "Yes." "Is that so?" exclaimed Hurstwood, otherwise concealing his astonishment. Alone? He added. Yes, said the clerk. Hurstwood turned away and set his lips so as best to express and conceal his feelings. How's that? He thought. They've had a row. He hastened to his room with rising spirits and changed his linen. As he did so, he made up his mind that if Carrie was alone, or if she had gone to another place, it behooved him to find out. He decided to call at once. I know what I'll do, he thought. I'll go to the door and ask if Mr. Drouet is at home. That will bring out whether he is there or not, and where Carrie is. He was almost moved to some muscular display as he thought of it. He decided to go immediately after supper. On coming down from his room at 6, he looked carefully about to see if Drouet was present, and then went out to lunch. He could scarcely eat, however. He was so anxious to be about his errand. Before starting, he thought it well to discover where Drouet would be and return to his hotel. "Has Mr. Drouet gone out?" he asked of the clerk. "No," answered the latter. "He's in his room. Do you wish to send up a card?" "No, I'll call around later," answered Hurstwood, and strolled out. He took a Madison car and went direct to Ogden Place, this time walking boldly up to the door. The chambermaid answered his knock. "Is Mr. Drouet in?" said Hurstwood blandly. "He is out of the city," said the girl who had heard Carrie tell this to Mrs. Hale. "Is Mrs. Drouet in?" "No, she has gone to the theater." "Is that so?" said Hurstwood, considerably taken back. Then, as if burdened with something important, "You don't know to which theater?" The girl really had no idea where she had gone, but not liking Hurstwood and wishing to cause him trouble, answered, "Yes, Hooley's." "Thank you," returned the manager, and, tipping his hat slightly, went away. "I'll look in at Hooley's," thought he, but as a matter of fact he did not. Before he had reached the central portion of the city, he thought the whole matter over and decided it would be useless. As much as he longed to see Carrie, he knew she would be with someone and did not wish to intrude with his plea there. A little later he might do so, in the morning. Only in the morning he had the lawyer question before him. This little pilgrimage threw quite a wet blanket upon his rising spirits. He was soon down again to his old worry, and reached the resort anxious to find relief. Quite a company of gentlemen were making the place lively with their conversation. A group of Cook County politicians were conferring about a round cherrywood table in the rear portion of the room. Several young merrymakers were chattering at the bar before making a belated visit to the theater. A shabbily genteel individual with a red nose and an old high hat was sipping a quiet glass of ale alone at one end of the bar. Hurstwood nodded to the politicians and went into his office. About 10 o'clock, a friend of his, Mr. Frank L. Tainter, a local sport and racing man, dropped in and, seeing Hurstwood alone in his office, came to the door. "Hello, George," he exclaimed. "How are you, Frank?" said Hurstwood, somewhat relieved by the sight of him. "Sit down," and he motioned him to one of the chairs in the little room. "What's the matter, George?" asked Tainter. "You look a little glum. Haven't lost at the track, have you?" "I'm not feeling very well tonight. I had a slight cold the other day." "Take whiskey, George," said Tainter. "You ought to know that." Hurstwood smiled. While they were still conferring there, several other of Hurstwood's friends entered, and not long after 11, the theaters being out, some actors began to drop in, among them some notabilities. Then began one of those pointless social conversations so common in American resorts, where the would-be gilded attempt to rub off guilt from those who have it in abundance. If Hurstwood had one leaning, it was toward notabilities. He considered that, if anywhere, he belonged among them. He was too proud to toady, too keen not to strictly observe the plane he occupied when there were those present who did not appreciate him. But in situations like the present, where he could shine as a gentleman and be received without equivocation as a friend and equal among men of known ability, he was most delighted. It was on such occasions, if ever, that he would take something. When the social flavor was strong enough, he would even unbend to the extent of drinking glass for glass with his associates, punctiliously observing his turn to pay as if he were an outsider like the others. If he ever approached intoxication, or rather that ruddy warmth and comfortableness which precedes the more sloven state, it was when individuals such as these were gathered about him, when he was one of a circle of chatting celebrities. Tonight, disturbed as was his state, he was rather relieved to find company, and now that notabilities were gathered, he laid aside his troubles for the nonce, and joined in right heartily. It was not long before the imbibing began to tell. Stories began to crop up, those ever-enduring droll stories which form the major portion of the conversation among American men under such circumstances. 12 o'clock arrived, the hour for closing, and with it the company took leave. Hurstwood shook hands with them most cordially. He was very roseate, physically. He had arrived at that state where his mind, though clear, was nevertheless warm in its fancies. He felt as if his troubles were not very serious. Going into his office, he began to turn over certain accounts, awaiting the departure of the bartenders and the cashier, who soon left. It was the manager's duty, as well as his custom, after all were gone, to see that everything was safely closed up for the night. As a rule, no money except the cash taken in after banking hours was kept about the place, and that was locked in the safe by the cashier, who, with the owners, was the joint keeper of the secret combination. But nevertheless, Hurstwood nightly took the precaution to try the cash drawers and the safe in order to see that they were tightly closed. Then he would lock his own little office and set the proper light burning near the safe, after which he would take his departure. Never in his experience had he found anything out of order, but tonight, after shutting down his desk, he came out and tried the safe. His way was to give a sharp pull. This time the door responded. He was slightly surprised at that, and looking in found the money cases as left for the day, apparently unprotected. His first thought was, of course, to inspect the drawers and shut the door. "I'll speak to Mayhew about this tomorrow," he thought. The latter had certainly imagined, upon going out a half hour before, that he had turned the knob on the door so as to spring the lock. He had never failed to do so before. But tonight Mayhew had other thoughts. He had been revolving the problem of a business of his own. "I'll look in here," thought the manager, pulling out the money drawers. He did not know why he wished to look in there. It was quite a superfluous action, which another time might not have happened at all. As he did so, a layer of bills in parcels of 1,000, such as banks issue, caught his eye. He could not tell how much they represented, but paused to view them. Then he pulled out the second of the cash drawers. In that were the receipts of the day. "I didn't know Fitzgerald and Moy ever left any money this way," his mind said to itself. "They must have forgotten it." He looked at the other drawer and paused again. "Count them," said a voice in his ear. He put his hand into the first of the boxes and lifted the stack, letting the separate parcels fall. They were bills of $50 and $100 done in packages of 1,000. He thought he counted 10 such. "Why don't I shut the safe?" his mind said to itself, lingering. "What makes me pause here?" For answer there came the strangest words. "Did you ever have $10,000 in ready money?" Lo, the manager remembered that he had never had so much. All his property had been slowly accumulated, and now his wife owned that. He was worth more than $40,000 all told, but she would get that. He puzzled as he thought of these things, then pushed in the drawers and closed the door, pausing with his hand upon the knob, which might so easily lock it all beyond temptation. Still he paused. Finally he went to the windows and pulled down the curtains. Then he tried the door, which he had previously locked. What was this thing making him suspicious? Why did he wish to move about so quietly? He came back to the end of the counter as if to rest his arm and think. Then he went and unlocked his little office door and turned on the light. He also opened his desk, sitting down before it, only to think strange thoughts. "The safe is open," said a voice. "There is just the least little crack in it. The lock has not been sprung." The manager floundered among a jumble of thoughts. Now all the entanglement of the day came back. Also the thought that here was a solution. That money would do it. If he had that and Carrie. He rose up and stood stock still, looking at the floor. "What about it?" his mind asked, and for answer he put his hand slowly up and scratched his head. The manager was no fool to be led blindly away by such an errant proposition as this, but his situation was peculiar. Wine was in his veins. It had crept up into his head and given him a warm view of the situation. It also colored the possibilities of 10,000 for him. He could see great opportunities with that. He could get Carrie. Oh, yes, he could. He could get rid of his wife. That letter, too, was waiting discussion tomorrow morning. He would not need to answer that. He went back to the safe and put his hand on the knob. Then he pulled the door open and took the drawer with the money quite out. With it once out and before him, it seemed a foolish thing to think about leaving it. Certainly it would. Why, he could live quietly with Carrie for years. Lord, what was that? For the first time he was tense, as if a stern hand had been laid upon his shoulder. He looked fearfully around. Not a soul was present. Not a sound. Someone was shuffling by on the sidewalk. He took the money in the box and put it back in the safe. Then he partly closed the door again. To those who have never wavered in conscience, the predicament of the individual whose mind is less strongly constituted and who trembles in the balance between duty and desire is scarcely appreciable unless graphically portrayed. Those who have never heard that solemn voice of the ghostly clock which ticks with awful distinctness, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, are in no position to judge. Not alone in sensitive, highly organized natures is such a mental conflict possible. The dullest specimen of humanity, when drawn by desire toward evil, is recalled by a sense of right, which is proportionate in power and strength to his evil tendency. We must remember that it may not be a knowledge of right, for no knowledge of right is predicated of the animal's instinctive recoil at evil. Men are still led by instinct before they are regulated by knowledge. It is instinct which recalls the criminal. It is instinct, where highly organized reasoning is absent, which gives the criminal his feeling of danger, his fear of wrong. At every first adventure, then, into some untried evil, the mind wavers. The clock of thought ticks out its wish and its denial. To those who have never experienced such a mental dilemma, the following will appeal on the simple ground of revelation. When Hurst would put the money back, his nature again resumed its ease and daring. No one had observed him. He was quite alone. No one could tell what he wished to do. He could work this thing out for himself. The imbibation of the evening had not yet worn off. Moist as was his brow, tremble as did his hand once after the nameless fright, he was still flushed with the fumes of liquor. He scarcely noticed that the time was passing. He went over his situation once again, his eye always seeing the money in a lump, his mind always seeing what it would do. He strolled into his little room, then to the door, then to the safe again. He put his hand on the knob and opened it. There was the money. Surely no harm could come from looking at it. He took out the drawer again and lifted the bills. They were so smooth, so compact, so portable. How little they made, after all. He decided he would take them. Yes, he would. He would put them in his pocket. Then he looked at that and saw they would not go there. His hand satchel. To be sure, his hand satchel. They would go in that. All of it would. No one would think anything of it either. He went into the little office and took it from the shelf in the corner. Now he set it upon his desk and went out toward the safe. For some reason, he did not want to fill it out in the big room. First he brought the bills and then the loose receipts of the day. He would take it all. He put the empty drawers back and pushed the iron door almost to, then stood beside it, meditating. The wavering of a mind under such circumstances is an almost inexplicable thing, and yet it is absolutely true. Hurstwood could not bring himself to act definitely. He wanted to think about it, to ponder over it, to decide whether it were best. He was drawn by such a keen desire for Carrie, driven by such a state of turmoil in his own affairs, that he thought constantly it would be best, and yet he wavered. He did not know what evil might result from it to him, how soon he might come to grief. The true ethics of the situation never once occurred to him, and never would have, under any circumstances. After he had all the money in the handbag, a revulsion of feeling seized him. He would not do it, no. Think of what a scandal it would make. The police, they would be after him. He would have to fly, and where? Oh, the terror of being a fugitive from justice. He took out the two boxes and put all the money back. In his excitement, he forgot what he was doing and put the sums in the wrong boxes. As he pushed the door to, he thought he remembered doing it wrong and opened the door again. There were the two boxes mixed. He took them out and straightened the matter, but now the terror had gone. Why be afraid? While the money was in his hand, the lock clicked. It had sprung. Did he do it? He grabbed at the knob and pulled vigorously. It had closed. Heavens, he was in for it now, sure enough. The moment he realized that the safe was locked for a surety, the sweat burst out upon his brow and he trembled violently. He looked about him and decided instantly. There was no delaying now. "Supposing I lay it on the top," he said, "and go away. They'll know who took it. I'm the last to close up. Besides, other things will happen." At once he became the man of action. "I must get out of this," he thought. He hurried into his little room, took down his light overcoat and hat, locked his desk, and grabbed the satchel. Then he turned out all but one light and opened the door. He tried to put on his old assured air, but it was almost gone. He was repenting rapidly. "I wish I hadn't done that," he said. "That was a mistake." He walked steadily down the street, greeting a night watchman whom he knew was trying doors. He must get out of the city, and that quickly. "I wonder how the trains run," he thought. Instantly he pulled out his watch and looked. It was nearly 1:30. At the first drugstore he stopped, seeing a long-distance telephone booth inside. It was a famous drugstore and contained one of the first private telephone booths ever erected. "I want to use your phone a minute," he said to the night clerk. The latter nodded. "Give me 1643, he called to Central, after looking up the Michigan Central depot number. Soon he got the ticket agent. "How do the trains leave here for Detroit?" he asked. The man explained the hours. "No more tonight." "Nothing with a sleeper." "Yes, there is too," he added. "There is a mail train out of here at 3:00. "All right," said Hurstwood. "What time does that get to Detroit?" He was thinking that if he could only get there and cross the river into Canada, he could take his time about getting to Montreal. He was relieved to learn that it would reach there by noon. "Mayhew won't open the safe until 9, he thought. "They can't get on my track before noon." Then he thought of Carrie. With what speed must he get her, if he got her at all? She would have to come along. He jumped into the nearest cab standing by. "To Ogden Place," he said sharply. "I'll give you $1 more if you make good time." The cabbie beat his horse into a sort of imitation gallop, which was fairly fast, however. On the way, Hurstwood thought what to do. Reaching the number, he hurried up the steps and did not spare the bell in waking the servant. "Is Mrs. Drouet in?" he asked. "Yes," said the astonished girl. "Tell her to dress and come to the door at once. Her husband is in the hospital, injured, and wants to see her." The servant girl hurried upstairs, convinced by the man's strained and emphatic manner.
What?
Said Carrie, lighting the gas and searching for her clothes. Mr. Jouet is hurt and in the hospital. He wants to see you. The cab's downstairs. Carrie dressed very rapidly and soon appeared below, forgetting everything save the necessities.
Jouet is hurt, said Hurstwood quickly.
He wants to see you. Come quickly. Carrie was so bewildered that she swallowed the whole story.
Get in, said Hurstwood, helping her and jumping after.
The cabbie began to turn the horse around.
Michigan Central Depot, he said, standing up and speaking so low that Carrie could not hear. As fast as you can go.
XXVIII. A Pilgrim, an Outlaw. The Spirit Detained. The cab had not traveled a short block before Carrie, settling herself and thoroughly waking in the night atmosphere, asked him, "What's the matter with him? Is he hurt badly?"
"It isn't anything very serious," Hurstwood said solemnly. He was very much disturbed over his own situation, and now that he had Carrie with him, he only wanted to get safely out of reach of the law. Therefore, he was in no mood for anything save such words as would further his plans distinctly. Carrie did not forget that there was something to be settled between her and Hurstwood, but the thought was ignored in her agitation. The one thing was to finish this strange pilgrimage.
Where is he?
Way out on the south side, said Hurstwood. We'll have to take the train. It's the quickest way. Carrie said nothing, and the horse gambled on. The weirdness of the city by night held her attention. She looked at the long receding rows of lamps and studied the dark, silent houses.
How did he hurt himself? She asked, meaning what was the nature of his injuries.
Hurstwood understood. He hated to lie any more than necessary, and yet he wanted no protests until he was out of danger.
I don't know exactly, he said. They just called me up to go and get you and bring you out. They said there wasn't any need for alarm, but that I shouldn't fail to bring you.
The man's serious manner convinced Carrie, and she became silent, wondering. Hurstwood examined his watch and urged the man to hurry. For one in so delicate a position, he was exceedingly cool. He could only think of how needful it was to make the train and get quietly away. Carrie seemed quite tractable, and he congratulated himself. In due time, they reached the depot, and after helping her out, he handed the man a $5 bill and hurried on. "You wait here," he said to Carrie when they reached the waiting room, "while I get the tickets." "Have I much time to catch that train for Detroit?" he asked of the agent.
4 minutes, said the latter.
He paid for 2 tickets as circumspectly as possible.
"Is it far?" said Carrie as he hurried back.
"Not very," he said. "We must get right in."
He pushed her before him at the gate, stood between her and the ticket man while the latter punched their tickets so that she could not see, and then hurried after. There was a long line of express and passenger cars, and one or two common day coaches. As the train had only recently been made up and few passengers were expected, there were only one or two brakemen waiting. They entered the rear day coach and sat down.
Almost immediately, "All aboard," resounded faintly from the outside, and the train started.
Carrie began to think it was a little bit curious, this going to a depot, but said nothing. The whole incident was so out of the natural that she did not attach too much weight to anything she imagined.
"How have you been?" asked Hurstwood gently, for he now breathed easier.
"Very well," said Carrie, who was so disturbed that she could not bring a proper attitude to bear in the matter. She was still nervous to reach Jouet and see what could be the matter. Hurstwood contemplated her and felt this. He was not disturbed that it should be so. He did not trouble because she was moved sympathetically in the matter. It was one of the qualities in her which pleased him exceedingly. He was only thinking how he should explain. Even this was not the most serious thing in his mind, however. His own deed and present flight were the great shadows which weighed upon him.
"What a fool I was to do that," he said over and over. "What a mistake."
In his sober senses, he could scarcely realize that the thing had been done. He could not begin to feel that he was a fugitive from justice. He had often read of such things, and had thought they must be terrible, But now that the thing was upon him, he only sat and looked into the past. The future was a thing which concerned the Canadian line. He wanted to reach that. As for the rest, he surveyed his actions for the evening and counted them parts of a great mistake. Still, he said, what could I have done? Then he would decide to make the best of it, and would begin to do so by starting the whole inquiry over again. It was a fruitless, harassing round, and left him in a queer mood to deal with a proposition he had in the presence of Carrie. The train clacked through the yards along the lakefront, and ran rather slowly to 24th Street. Brakes and signals were visible without. The engine gave short calls with its whistle, and frequently the bell rang. Several brakemen came through, bearing lanterns. They were locking the vestibules and putting the cars in order for a long run. Presently it began to gain speed, and Carrie saw the silent streets flashing by in rapid succession. The engine also began its whistle calls of four parts, with which it signaled danger to important crossings. "Is it very far?" asked Carrie. "Not so very," said Hurstwood. He could hardly repress a smile at her simplicity. He wanted to explain and conciliate her, but he also wanted to be well out of Chicago. In the lapse of another half hour, it became apparent to Carrie that it was quite a run to wherever he was taking her, anyhow. "Is it in Chicago?" she asked nervously. They were now far beyond the city limits, and the train was scudding across the Indiana line at a great rate. "No," he said, "not where we are going." There was something in the way he said this which roused her in an instant. Her pretty brow began to contract. "We are going to see Charlie, aren't we?" she asked. He felt that the time was up. An explanation might as well come now as later. Therefore he shook his head in the most gentle negative. "What?" said Carrie. She was nonplussed at the possibility of the errand being different from what she had thought. He only looked at her in the most kindly and mollifying way.
"Well, where are you taking me, then?" she asked, her voice showing the quality of fright.
"I'll tell you, Carrie, if you'll be quiet. I want you to come along with me to another city."
"Oh," said Carrie, her voice rising into a weak cry. "Let me off. I don't want to go with you."
She was quite appalled at the man's audacity. This was something which had never for a moment entered her head. Her one thought now was to get off and away. If only the flying train could be stopped, the terrible trick would be amended. She arose and tried to push out into the aisle, anywhere. She knew she had to do something. Hurstwood laid a gentle hand on her.
"Sit still, Carrie," he said. "Sit still. It won't do you any good to get up here. Listen to me, and I'll tell you what I'll do. Wait a moment." She was pushing at his knees, but he only pulled her back. No one saw this little altercation, for very few persons were in the car, and they were attempting to doze.
"I won't," said Carrie, who was, nevertheless, complying against her will. "Let me go," she said. "How dare you?"
And large tears began to gather in her eyes. Hurstwood was now fully aroused to the immediate difficulty, and ceased to think of his own situation. He must do something with this girl, or she would cause him trouble. He tried the art of persuasion with all his powers aroused.
"Look here now, Carrie," he said. "You mustn't act this way. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I don't want to do anything to make you feel bad."
"Oh," sobbed Carrie. Oh.
There, he said. "You mustn't cry. Won't you listen to me? Listen to me a minute, and I'll tell you why I came to do this thing. I couldn't help it. I assure you I couldn't. Won't you listen?"
Her sobs disturbed him so that he was quite sure she did not hear a word he said.
"Won't you listen?" he asked.
"No, I won't," said Carrie, flashing up. "I want you to take me out of this, or I'll tell the conductor. I won't go with you. It's a shame."
And again sobs of fright cut off her desire for expression. Hurstwood listened with some astonishment. He felt that she had just cause for feeling as she did, and yet he wished that he could straighten this thing out quickly. Shortly, the conductor would come through for the tickets. He wanted no noise, no trouble of any kind. Before everything, he must make her quiet.
"You couldn't get out until the train stops again," said Hurstwood. "It won't be very long until we reach another station. You can get out then if you want to. I won't stop you. All I want you to do is listen a moment. You'll let me tell you, won't you?"
Carrie seemed not to listen. She only turned her head toward the window, where outside all was black. The train was speeding with steady grace across the fields and through patches of wood. The long whistles came with sad, musical effect as the lonely woodland crossings were approached. Now the conductor entered the car and took up the one or two fares that had been added at Chicago. He approached Hurstwood, who handed out the tickets. Poised as she was to act, Carrie made no move. She did not look about. When the conductor had gone again, Hurstwood felt relieved.
"You're angry at me because I deceived you," he said. "I didn't mean to, Carrie. As I live, I didn't. I couldn't help it. I couldn't stay away from you after the first time I saw you."
He was ignoring the last deception as something that might go by the board. He wanted to convince her that his wife could no longer be a factor in their relationship. The money he had stolen, he tried to shut out of his mind.
"Don't talk to me," said Carrie. "I hate you. I want you to go away from me. I am going to get out at the very next station."
She was in a tremble of excitement and opposition as she spoke.
"All right," he said. "But you'll hear me out, won't you? After all you have said about loving me, you might hear me. I don't want to do you any harm. I'll give you the money to go back with when you go. I merely want to tell you, Carrie, you can't stop me from loving you, whatever you may think."
He looked at her tenderly, but received no reply.
"You think I have deceived you badly, but I haven't. I didn't do it willingly. I'm through with my wife. She hasn't any claims on me. I'll never see her any more. That's why I'm here tonight. That's why I came and got you." "You said Charlie was hurt," said Carrie savagely. "You deceived me. You've been deceiving me all the time, and now you want to force me to run away with you."
She was so excited that she got up and tried to get by him again. He let her, and she took another seat. Then he followed.
"Don't run away from me, Carrie," he said gently. "Let me explain. If you will only hear me out, you will see where I stand. I tell you, my wife is nothing to me. She hasn't been anything for years, or I wouldn't have ever come near you. I'm going to get a divorce just as soon as I can. I'll never see her again. I'm done with all that. You're the only person I want. If I can have you, I won't ever think of another woman again."
Carrie heard all this in a very ruffled state. It sounded sincere enough, however, despite all he had done. There was a tenseness in Hurstwood's voice and manner which could but have some effect. She did not want anything to do with him. He was married. He had deceived her once and now again, and she thought him terrible. Still, there is something in such daring and power which is fascinating to a woman, especially if she can be made to feel that it is all prompted by love of her. The progress of the train was having a great deal to do with the solution of this difficult situation. The speeding wheels and disappearing country put Chicago farther and farther behind. Carrie could feel that she was being borne a long distance off, that the engine was making an almost through run to some distant city. She felt at times as if she could cry out and make such a row that someone would come to her aid. At other times it seemed an almost useless thing, so far was she from any aid, no matter what she did. All the while Hurstwood was endeavoring to formulate his plea in such a way that it would strike home and bring her into sympathy with him.
"I was simply put where I didn't know what else to do."
Carrie deigned no suggestion of hearing this.
"When I saw you wouldn't come unless I could marry you, I decided to put everything else behind me and get you to come away with me. I'm going off now to another city. I want to go to Montreal for a while, and then anywhere you want to. We'll go and live in New York, if you say.
I'll not have anything to do with you, said Carrie. I want to get off this train. Where are we going?
To Detroit, said Hurstwood.
Oh, said Carrie, in a burst of anguish. So distant and definite a point seemed to increase the difficulty.
Won't you come along with me? He said, as if there was great danger that she would not. You won't need to do anything but travel with me. I'll not trouble you in any way. You can see Montreal and New York, and then if you don't want to stay, you can go back. It will be better than trying to go back tonight.
The first gleam of fairness shone in this proposition for Carrie. It seemed a plausible thing to do, much as she feared his opposition if she tried to carry it out. Montreal and New York. Even now she was speeding toward those great, strange lands, and could see them if she liked. She thought, but made no sign. Hurstwood thought he saw a shade of compliance in this. He redoubled his ardor.
Think, he said, what I've given up. I can't go back to Chicago anymore. I've got to stay away and live alone now, if you don't come with me. You won't go back on me entirely, will you, Carrie?
I don't want you to talk to me, she answered forcibly.
Hurstwood kept silent for a while. Carrie felt the train to be slowing down. It was the moment to act, if she was to act at all. She stirred uneasily.
Don't think of going, Carrie, he said. If you ever cared for me at all, come along and let's start right. I'll do whatever you say. I'll marry you, or I'll let you go back. Give yourself time to think it over. I wouldn't have wanted you to come if I hadn't loved you. I tell you, Carrie, before God, I can't live without you. I won't.
There was the tensity of fierceness in the man's plea which appealed deeply to her sympathies. It was a dissolving fire which was actuating him now. He was loving her too intensely to think of giving her up in this, his hour of distress. He clutched her hand nervously and pressed it with all the force of an appeal. The train was now all but stopped. It was running by some cars on a sidetrack. Everything outside was dark and dreary. A few sprinkles on the window began to indicate that it was raining. Carrie hung in a quandary, balancing between decision and helplessness. Now the train stopped, and she was listening to his plea. The engine backed a few feet, and all was still. She wavered, totally unable to make a move. Minute after minute slipped by, and still she hesitated, he pleading.
"Will you let me come back if I want to?" she asked, as if she now had the upper hand and her companion was utterly subdued.
"Of course," he answered. "You know I will."
Carrie only listened as one who was granted a temporary amnesty. She began to feel as if the matter were in her hands entirely. The train was again in rapid motion. Hurstwood changed the subject.
"Aren't you very tired?" he said.
No, she answered.
Won't you let me get you a berth in the sleeper?
She shook her head, though for all her distress and his trickery, she was beginning to notice what she had always felt, his thoughtfulness.
Oh, yes, he said. You will feel so much better.
She shook her head.
Let me fix my coat for you anyway, and he arose and arranged his light coat in a comfortable position to receive her head.
There. He said tenderly, "Now see if you can't rest a little." He could have kissed her for her compliance. He took a seat beside her and thought a moment.
"I believe we're in for a heavy rain," he said.
"So it looks," said Carrie, whose nerves were quieting under the sound of the raindrops, driven by a gusty wind, as the train swept on frantically through the shadow to a newer world. The fact that he had in a measure mollified Carrie was a source of satisfaction to Hurstwood, but it furnished only the most temporary relief. Now that her opposition was out of the way, he had all of his time to devote to the consideration of his own error. His condition was bitter in the extreme, for he did not want the miserable sum he had stolen. He did not want to be a thief. That sum or any other could never compensate for the state which he had thus foolishly doffed. It could not give him back his host of friends, his name, his house and family, nor Carrie as he had meant to have her. He was shut out from Chicago, from his easy, comfortable state. He had robbed himself of his dignity, his merry meetings, his pleasant evenings. And for what? The more he thought of it, the more unbearable it became. He began to think that he would try and restore himself to his old state. He would return the miserable thievings of the night and explain. Perhaps Moy would understand. Perhaps they would forgive him and let him come back. By noontime, the train rolled into Detroit, and he began to feel exceedingly nervous. The police must be on his track by now. They had probably notified all the police of the big cities, and detectives would be watching for him. He remembered instances in which defaulters had been captured. Consequently, he breathed heavily and paled somewhat. His hands felt as if they must have something to do. He simulated interest in several scenes without, which he did not feel. He repeatedly beat his foot upon the floor. Carrie noticed his agitation, but said nothing. She had no idea what it meant, or that it was important. He wondered now why he had not asked whether this train went on through to Montreal or some Canadian point. Perhaps he could have saved time. He jumped up and sought the conductor. "Does any part of this train go to Montreal?" he asked. "Yes, the next sleeper back does." He would have asked more, but it did not seem wise, so he decided to inquire at the depot. The train rolled into the yards, clanging and puffing. "I think we had better go right on through to Montreal," he said to Carrie. "I'll see what the connections are when we get off." He was exceedingly nervous, but did his best to put on a calm exterior. Carrie only looked at him with large, troubled eyes. She was drifting mentally, unable to say to herself what to do. The train stopped and Hurstwood led the way out. He looked warily around him, pretending to look after Carrie. Seeing nothing that indicated studied observation, he made his way to the ticket office. "The next train for Montreal leaves when?" he asked. "In 20 minutes," said the man. He bought 2 tickets and Pullman berths. Then he hastened back to Carrie. "We'll go right out again," he said, scarcely noticing that Carrie looked tired and weary.
"I wish I was out of all this," she exclaimed gloomily.
"You'll feel better when we reach Montreal," he said.
"I haven't an earthly thing with me," said Carrie. "Not even a handkerchief."
"You can buy all you want as soon as you get there, dearest," he explained. "You can call in a dressmaker." Now the crier called the train ready, and they got on. Hurstwood breathed a sigh of relief as it started. There was a short run to the river, and there they were ferried over. They had barely pulled the train off the ferry boat when he settled back with a sigh. "It won't be so very long now," he said, remembering her in his relief. "We get there the first thing in the morning." Carrie scarcely deigned to reply. "I'll see if there's a dining car," he added. "I'm hungry." 29. The solace of travel, the boats of the sea. To the untraveled, territory other than their own familiar health is invariably fascinating. Next to love, it is the one thing which solaces and delights. Things new are too important to be neglected, and mind, which is a mere reflection of sensory impressions, succumbs to the flood of objects. Thus, lovers are forgotten, sorrows laid aside, death hidden from view. There is a world of accumulated feeling back of the trite, dramatic expression, "I am going away." As Carrie looked out upon the flying scenery, she almost forgot that she had been tricked into this long journey against her will, and that she was without the necessary apparel for traveling. She quite forgot Hurstwood's presence at times, and looked away to homely farmhouses and cozy cottages in villages with wondering eyes. It was an interesting world to her. Her life had just begun. She did not feel herself defeated at all. Neither was she blasted in hope. The great city held much. Possibly she would come out of bondage into freedom. Who knows? Perhaps she would be happy. These thoughts raised her above the level of erring. She was saved in that she was hopeful. The following morning, the train pulled safely into Montreal and they stepped down, Hurstwood glad to be out of danger, Carrie wondering at the novel atmosphere of the northern city. Long before, Hurstwood had been here, and now he remembered the name of the hotel at which he had stopped. As they came out of the main entrance of the depot, he heard it called anew by a busman. "We'll go right up and get rooms," he said. At the clerk's office, Hurstwood swung the register about while the clerk came forward. He was thinking what name he would put down. With the ladder before him, he found no time for hesitation. A name he had seen out of the car window came swiftly to him. It was pleasing enough. With an easy hand, he wrote, G.W. Murdoch and wife. It was the largest concession to necessity he felt like making. His initials he could not spare. When they were shown their room, Carrie saw at once that he had secured her a lovely chamber. "You have a bath there," said he. "Now you can clean up when you get ready." Carrie went over and looked out the window, while Hurstwood looked at himself in the glass. He felt dusty and unclean. He had no trunk, no change of linen, not even a hairbrush. "I'll ring for soap and towels," he said, "and send you up a hairbrush. Then you can bathe and get ready for breakfast. I'll go for a shave and come back and get you, and then we'll go out and look for some clothes for you." He smiled good-naturedly as he said this. "All right," said Carrie. She sat down in one of the rocking chairs while Hurstwood waited for the boy, who soon knocked. "Soap, towels, and a pitcher of ice water."
"Yes, sir."
"I'll go now," he said to Carrie, coming toward her and holding out his hands, but she did not move to take them. "You're not mad at me, are you?" he asked softly.
"Oh, no," she answered rather indifferently.
"Don't you care for me at all?" She made no answer but looked steadily toward the window. "Don't you think you could love me a little?" he pleaded, taking one of her hands, which she endeavored to draw away. "You once said you did."
"What made you deceive me so?" asked Carrie.
"I couldn't help it," he said. "I wanted you too much."
"You didn't have any right to want me," she answered, striking cleanly home.
"Oh, well, Carrie," he answered, "here I am. It's too late now. Won't you try and care for me a little?" He looked rather worsted in thought as he stood before her. She shook her head negatively. "Let me start all over again. Be my wife from today on."
Carrie rose up as if to step away, he holding her hand. Now he slipped his arm about her and she struggled, but in vain. He held her quite close. Instantly there flamed up in his body the all-compelling desire. His affection took an ardent form.
"Let me go," said Carrie, who was folded close to him.
"Won't you love me?" he said. "Won't you be mine from now on?"
Carrie had never been ill-disposed toward him. Only a moment before she had been listening with some complacency, remembering her old affection for him. He was so handsome, so daring. Now, however, this feeling had changed to one of opposition which rose feebly. It mastered her for a moment, and then, held close as she was, began to wane. Something else in her spoke. This man, to whose bosom she was being pressed, was strong. He was passionate. He loved her, and she was alone. If she did not turn to him, except of his love, where else might she go? Her resistance half dissolved in the flood of his strong feeling. She found him lifting her head and looking into her eyes. What magnetism there was, she could never know. His many sins, however, were for the moment all forgotten. He pressed her closer and kissed her, and she felt that further opposition was useless.
"Will you marry me?"
she asked, forgetting how.
"This very day," he said, with all delight.
Now the hall boy pounded on the door, and he released his hold upon her regretfully.
"You get ready now, will you?" he said. "At once?"
"Yes," she answered.
"I'll be back in 3/4 of an hour.
Carrie, flushed and excited, moved away as he admitted the boy. Below stairs, he halted in the lobby to look for a barber shop. For the moment, he was in fine feather. His recent victory over Carrie seemed to atone for much he had endured during the last few days. Life seemed worth fighting for. This eastward flight from all things customary and attached seemed as if it might have happiness in store. The storm showed a rainbow at the end of which might be a pot of gold. He was about to cross to a little red and white striped bar which was fastened up beside a door when a voice greeted him familiarly. Instantly his heart sank.
"Well, hello, George, old man," said the voice. "What are you doing down here?"
Hurstwood was already confronted and recognized his friend Kenny, the stockbroker.
"Just attending to a little private matter," he answered, his mind working like a keyboard of a telephone station. This man evidently did not know. He had not read the papers. "Well, it seems strange to see you way up here," said Mr. Kenny genially. "Stopping here?"
"Yes," said Hurstwood uneasily, thinking of his handwriting on the register.
"Going to be in town long?"
"No, only a day or so."
"Is that so? Had you breakfast?"
"Yes," said Hurstwood, lying blandly. "I'm just going for a shave."
"Won't you come have a drink?"
"Not until afterward," said the ex-manager.
"I'll see you later. Are you stopping here?"
"Yes," said Mr. Kenny. And then, turning the word again, added,
"How are things out in Chicago?"
"About the same as usual," said Hurstwood, smiling genially.
"Wife with you?"
"No."
"Well, I must see more of you today. I'm just going in here for breakfast. Come in when you're through."
"I will," said Hurstwood, moving away. The whole conversation was a trial to him. It seemed to add complications with every word. This man called up 1,000 memories. He represented everything he had left. Chicago, his wife, the elegant resort, all these were in his greeting and inquiries. And here he was in this same hotel expecting to confer with him, unquestionably waiting to have a good time with him. All at once the Chicago papers would arrive. The local papers would have accounts in them this very day. He forgot his triumph with Carrie and the possibility of soon being known for what he was, in this man's eyes, a safe-breaker. He could have groaned as he went into the barber shop. He decided to escape and seek a more secluded hotel. Accordingly, when he came out, he was glad to see the lobby clear and hastened toward the stairs. He would get Carrie and go out by the ladies' entrance. They would have breakfast in some more inconspicuous place. Across the lobby, however, another individual was surveying him. He was of a commonplace Irish type, small of stature, cheaply dressed, and with a head that seemed a smaller edition of some huge ward politician's. This individual had been evidently talking with the clerk, but now he surveyed the ex-manager keenly. Hurstwood felt the long-range examination and recognized the type. Instinctively, he felt that the man was a detective, that he was being watched. He hurried across, pretending not to notice, but in his mind was a world of thoughts. What would happen now? What could these people do?